We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers for the program are Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. A growing number of businesses today define themselves as socially responsible. They're concerned with the environmental impact of the products that they make and of the way that they make them. They want to be good corporate citizens. At the same time, these companies expect to make money. The question is it really possible to do both, to be profitable and socially responsible? Well, there are a number of companies that would say yes. The answer to that question is yes. We'll be talking this morning with Bill Breen. He is the editorial director of Seventh Generation. He is also the co-author of with Gary Hamel of the book The Future of Management, which was selected by Amazon.com as the best business book of 2007. And he's also the co-author with Jeff Hollander, who is the co-founder chairman of Seventh Generation, the co-author of a book that we'll be talking about this morning, The Responsibility Revolution, How the Next Generation of Businesses Will Win. That's the subtitle. The book's published by Jossi Bass. It's just come out recently and talks about companies that are trying to move ahead in this way of responsibility. We'll talk about what some of them are and what corporate responsibility nowadays means. And questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We also have email. You can send us your comments and questions to will-talk, that's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, you certainly are welcome to call or write and join the conversation. Mr. Breen, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about Seventh Generation, just to start us off.
Sure. Seventh Generation was founded a little over 20 years ago in Burlington, Vermont. It is one of the country's leading producers of green household cleaning products and personal care products. And it is an organization that is very much built around what you might call its values or its global imperatives, which start with the products that it makes, insofar as trying to lessen their impact on the environment. They take on a mission also of trying to influence other companies to move in a more sustainable direction. You might consider Seventh Generation one of the pioneers of the corporate responsibility movement here in this country, along with Ben & Jerry's right up the road from them in Vermont, other companies like Patagonia, Timberland might be considered in that group as well. And as I say, they've been working on this mission for over 20 years, and in an effort to sort of influence other companies to move in a more sustainable direction, I collaborated on this book with Jeffrey Collender, who is the co-founder and chairman of the company.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are a lot of companies now that, as a part of their marketing, they're incorporating this kind of language. They're talking about sustainability. They're talking about environmental impact. They're talking about their place in their communities. They're talking about their labor policies, all those sorts of things. But I think that it leads to a question like, what exactly is the difference between using that language as a marketing and promotional tool and actually putting those things into practice in a meaningful way?
Right. Well, actually, you sort of hit on one of the central themes of our book. So just to step back, the discussion around corporate social responsibility has been an ongoing one for many years. David Packard, the co-founder of Hewlett-Packard, said back in actually 1939 that part of a company's obligation is to contribute to society. A phrase that he said might sound trite, but that actually is fundamental to a company's success. We then saw how corporate responsibility, this notion of responsibility, came to the fore in the 60s and 70s, and it's been sort of ebbing and flowing ever since. I'd say where we are right now is corporate responsibility has never been higher on most CEOs' radar screens. Survey after survey shows that it's of tremendous concern to companies. Something like 52,000 web pages and growing are dedicated to this idea of a triple bottom line, that is profits, people, and the environment. Where we sort of see companies start to get in trouble, in fact, is they really don't think about corporate responsibility any deeper than their marketing. That the marketing is the perhaps the easiest way for them to convey these messages, but they don't think about how, or really don't think through how they can use it to frame their strategies, to create a different kind of workplace, to differentiate themselves from their competitors. And what we're trying to do in the book is say it's great for companies to talk about how they're saving watts, cutting carbon, giving to philanthropic causes, but they really need to use corporate sustainability, corporate responsibility, to reframe the way they work in the world. And it can be a great competitive weapon for companies if they think this through. The problem is a lot of them haven't thought it through.
We have opportunity for people to call in here with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest this morning is Bill Breen. He's the editorial director of Seventh Generation. It is the nation's fastest-growing brand of natural home and personal care products. He is the co-author, along with Jeffrey Hollander, who was the co-founder of Seventh Generation. The two of them together have written this book. The title is The Responsibility Revolution, the subtitle How the Next Generation of Business Will Win. Businesses will win. Jossie Bass is the publisher of the book, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that it is true that some of the companies that you've talked about and others that you haven't named have established that you can't, by embracing certain kinds of principles, that you can be good members of the community, you could be good corporate citizens, you can feel good about the way that you do business, and you can be a successful company. So there are case studies that says you can do it and be successful. When other companies look at this, I guess I just wonder, does it really matter whether you do this as a strategy of being successful? That is, if you say, well, this can be a path to success, so let's do that. Or you're doing it, you start out doing it kind of because you think that that's just the right thing to do.
Right. So there might be a different motivation for getting into it and whether that may weigh on your success or not.
Well, I guess I just wonder, you know, does it matter if the end goal is to have a certain kind of attitude and a certain kind of impact, does it really matter whether you're doing it for moral reasons or whether you're doing it because you think it just makes good business sense?
Well, the fact is, you know, when you look across the influencers on companies, you know, consumers are increasingly expecting that you act this way, particularly the younger generation of consumers. NGOs, you know, non-governmental organization, activist groups, are a growing force in the world's economy, and they are putting greater pressure on companies to do this. So there's sort of the pressure argument, and you might look at examples of companies like Nike and Timberland, which were sort of pressured, quote unquote, to move in a more responsible direction. But there's also the attractions and opportunities that await. We know from survey after survey shows that people want to work for companies that are making a difference in the world, that they feel that they are more rewarded and that they can bring their creativity and passion to their work because they believe in the cause that the company is championing. So that can be a real magnet for high-end talent for companies. But the fact is, you know, when you look at environmental issues such as global climate change, that is affecting the way companies set their strategy. And one of the companies that we profiled in the book is Nike, and they have people who are studying, you know, future events and the way that the environment and also social regulatory systems are affecting them. And for one example, Nike uses a tremendous amount of oil and water in the production of their products, and they know that over the long term, water and oil prices are going to increase. So they are experimenting now with waterless dyes and other innovations that can help them thrive in an economy where companies that continually to use those resources on a higher end will be punished by that. So it's a very pragmatic business case that Nike is looking at that is pushing them to innovate. It's just not because they simply want to do good or because it's good marketing, which it is, but it's also these factors are you can look at them either as pressures or opportunities in which they can differentiate themselves and succeed in a world where resources are going to become more expensive.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point that there are various companies have found that by moving to being more green in their manufacturing process, that actually is positive for their bottom line.
Sure, and it's also helping companies develop whole new opportunities. For instance, IBM has a process they call Global Innovation Outlook, where they bring in some of the world's leading thinkers on issues like Africa, water, sustainability, security, and they'll bring them. They do these conversations all over the world, and they'll hold a day-long conversation about the topic. The rules are any idea that comes out of this, anybody can own it, quote-unquote, and develop it. But in bringing in these best thinkers to think about challenges to society and the environment, like poverty in Africa, scarce water supplies the world over, IBM is also looking for business ideas that will help them arrive first at the future. They're emanating sort of faint signals on the horizon that will show what are the next opportunities for them to build services and products that will help their company. But they're starting from a place where they're saying, hey, there's great challenges to the world and the world's economy. We have a responsibility for, as a company, as an enterprise, for solving some of these challenges. And let's bring in the world's brightest minds to talk about them. So it's sort of a pragmatic business argument for doing this. And IBM has launched entire new enterprises and efforts around some of these conversations. But they start off from a place where the notion is we all have a responsibility to start solving problems rather than simply causing them.
Mm. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is here in Urbana, where we are, and line one. Hello.
Yes. I want to thank you very much for your company.
Thank you.
Yes, it's like a lifesaver to myself and my sister. My sister has chemical sensitivity. She cannot breathe in any kind of fragrances, any kind of she has an autoimmune disease. This is in the list of many autoimmune diseases. And there's lots of people with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And your product was like a lifesaver. I mean, I couldn't find anything to wash my clothes in, to clean my house with. And then your products came, and it was just like the best thing in the world. So I really applaud what you're doing. I think that all companies should be looking to this direction because there's a lot of chemicals in this country that are killing people and they don't know it. And we're going to have, I think, more of this happening as time goes on because people aren't aware that these chemicals are really deadly. And they need something. You know, they need something that they can use, and your company is really one of the ones out there that are really great, and I applaud you for it, and I really hope that you keep working at this because it's so important to the people out here and their health, and I think that it's moving that way anyway, and the environment, too, all of that is connected.
Well, we really appreciate your comments, and I'm so glad this is helping you and your family.
Thank you.
And we know we're on the right path because other larger companies are now sort of competing with us in our space. So that can be taken as a good sign.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. With the kind of program products that you folks sell, there is a very specific kind of person, and they're definitely interested in that product for its features, as this caller has illustrated. But I wonder if for, you know, for the broad range of products, let's, you know, take, for example, a pair of sneakers, you know, how I wonder, I'm sure that there are some people who would want to know and would be concerned about how that was manufactured.
Right.
But that I'm guessing that probably there might be a larger number of people who just wouldn't care or wouldn't be that interested. I guess
exactly.
I wondered, you know, to what extent that ends up being a motivating factor for significant numbers of consumers as they make their choices.
Sure. Well, in fact, you know, for some it does, and for others it doesn't make any difference at all. But and yet companies are still innovating around this area. So we can move on from Nike, but I'll just give you one more example from them. What they've been looking at is they've been thinking about how can we push sustainability concerns further up the innovation pipeline, because so much of it is right now about monitoring stuff, and there's that sort of responsibility word that we monitor how our factories are doing and we issue these reports and evaluations. But is that really helping us make a competitive difference in the world? Well, you could say to some extent it is because we can market around it. But how do we get sort of the people who actually create our products involved? And they did this with Nike did this with their designers, where they challenged the designers to think about sustainability in the way they design. And they actually created a program, a software program, that rates designers on the choices that they make. So, for instance, in the adhesives that Nike had used, there's a lot of chemicals in those adhesives that are damaging to human health and the environment. So if you're a designer and you choose to make one of those things, it's perfectly legal, perfectly ethical, you know, in a sense to do so, but you're going to get a lower score than you would if you could think of a way to eliminate adhesives. And that's what Nike did in its latest Air Jordan sneaker, the Michael Jordan sneaker. It eliminated adhesives and instead found a way to snap on the various component parts that comprise that sneaker. And it resulted in because Nike developed it through a sustainability lens, it gave the shoe a very radically different look. And that came from sustainability and just thinking in terms of how do we guarantee the performance of this shoe and make it perform up to the standards of a Michael Jordan. It resulted in a radically different look. But Nike didn't really market it that way. They did not market it as the greenest shoe they ever produced, which it was, because they knew that a lot of the buyers of Michael Jordan really don't care about that. But it made a great difference internally to Nike's bottom line in terms of the cost of the shoe, the radically different look of it, because it came through sustainability, and they're forecasting now that this will be the most successful Air Jordan they've done to date. And Michael Jordan, who at first was very skeptical of it, is now wholeheartedly behind the campaign.
Hmm. I'm sure that one of the challenges that companies face when they think about these things is if they're going to take on some sort of a cause or they're going to try to embrace some set of principles and try to see those embodied in the way they think about their products, the way they design them, manufacture them, sell them, their place in the community, all that, that can be a very big undertaking. And I think that one of the things that you have as a cautionary note here in the book is that you ought to be careful about being too ambitious, you know, trying to do too much. And I wonder how it is you would say companies are thinking about that, and particularly whether whatever it is they choose to do, does it really have to remain connected with the product or the business that they're in?
It absolutely needs to remain connected. I mean, it's a challenge, and it's something that cannot be done overnight. I mean, Seventh Generation has been working at this for more than 20 years, and we're still sort of reformulating, you know, what we call them. We don't call it our mission, but what are our imperatives? And these are sort of the values that the company operates around, and we're continually trying to sort of fix the language so it's memorable for people and they can work from it without a lot of confusion. So it is a process, and it does sort of change. I mean, you can't just come up with one sort of mission and expect that it's going to live through all the changes that any company can faces these days. But it does need to speak to the sort of the core, I would say almost the core DNA or belief of the company as it was founded. And every company has that. You look at any kind of company, and it has its own culture and its beliefs. And the mission should in some way try to spring from that. Now, companies go through ebbs and flows, and IBM, who I mentioned previously, went through a period where they were having their turnaround, you know, in the late 90s, where they sort of lost touch with their values, and they actually created something called a values jam, where they invited everybody online for 3 days to talk about what are our values, what should they be, and to help define them. This is a company that is, you know, quite old and has been around, you know, for a very long time, but in the early 2000s it felt it needed to update those values. And it did so, and because it invited everybody in the company to participate, the values therefore become more genuine and more authentic to the people, and it doesn't feel like it's just been handed down from the CEO and the board, but it's something that actually lives and thrives. But I think it has a lot to do with the founder's sort of philosophy, and this is something where the CEO or the leaders of the organization sort of have to set the tone. But it's more authentic if the people step up and have a role in actually creating and identifying and defining that mission moving forward.
We have another caller. Let's talk with them in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'm curious to know if you address in your book the Milton Friedman type of antisocial engineering argument that argues that any attempt to tie or restrain business, profit-making, hiring, promotion, whatever, to moral ends is counterproductive, and that from a macro perspective, as I recall, Friedman arguing capitalism and good business and the creation of jobs is the ultimate moral end of it in and of itself, and that we shouldn't even focus on moral issues. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right, sure, absolutely. And you know, back in, I think it was 1962, Milton Friedman made the argument that, you know, the social responsibility, the only real social responsibility for an enterprise is to make money for their stock, as much money as possible for their stockholders. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a age-long argument, and I think it will persist. And we really wanted to move on from that, and I think that's the sort of the revolutionary part of the book's title comes from. There are true believers on both sides of this argument, and we're not going to sway. We don't believe we can really sway or change the minds of those who believe that Milton Friedman, you know, said it all and said it all correctly, although I would agree that he has a powerful argument. What we are trying to do in this book is to say to companies that really want to move beyond just a marketing argument for this, but to that understand that the way that sustainability can offer a way of differentiating their companies from the competition, that sustainability can be a way for them to reimagine the way they work and organize their workplaces. I mean, what is a good company workplace? What does that look like? How does that feel? The way a company can strategize and set strategy and compete is a real advantage for companies. And whether they believe it or not, I think changes in society and environment are going to force many companies in this direction. So for those who want to stay out in the forefront of these changes, what are the obstacles that they face and how do they overcome them? So I guess what we're saying in this book is we're a manifesto for change, but we're not trying to convince people who are believers, true believers of Milton Friedman. We're more trying to help those companies that really want to move along this path. And so we're a manifesto for change, but we're trying to be a manual for achieving it.
Well, I guess I continue to think about the fact that while there are a number of really notable examples of companies who are trying to do this, and we're not just talking about small companies, I mean, some of them are very large,
yes,
that they still seem to be a minority, and that that corporate culture, I hate to make a sweeping generalization, but the corporate culture generally now seems to be still going in the other direction. And why is it that this kind of thinking is not more widespread, particularly given the fact that it is good marketing strategy?
Well, I don't know. I guess I would disagree with you just a little bit that, in fact, it is quite widespread. Mm. I mean, it's never really been more widespread than it is now, but I take your point that it should be deeper. I think that's part of what you're saying. It should run more deeply. And certainly, you know, sort of the companies that got us into the recession, the Wall Street companies, et cetera, would show that we have not been, despite CEOs' proclamations that they're trying to act more responsibility, it has been pretty much business as usual. So I certainly take your point. What I would say is that I think there are more companies, and the evidence shows that there are more companies trying to use sustainability and responsibility as a way to strategize and to set themselves apart from their competitors, they recognize the business advantages in that. One of the companies that we profiled in the book is Marks & Spencer, which is one of the largest British retailers. They're based in London. And they argue that, you know, they'll say to you, and they're about as tough-minded a business people as you could meet. You know, they call the corporate responsibility of folks the Bunny Brigade, and they have, you know, they continually sort of mock people who believe in this stuff. But at the same time, they have embraced it wholeheartedly. And their argument is, we can't compete with Tesco and Walmart on price. They're just too big. But if we can drag them on a terrain where we can compete with them around responsibility and sustainability, then we've got a chance. And so it's a way for them to sort of differentiate themselves from their competitors, but they also know they're going to get burned very badly if they do it just on a marketing play. Because with the Internet and everything, there's just so much transparency around a company's movements. And so if you're not really doing what you say you're going to do, you're going to get in trouble very quickly. So, you know, to speak to your point some more, you know, at the same time that we've seen this rise in perception among chief executives that this is important and more of them are speaking out about it, we've also seen a rise in greenwashing, which is dishonest or false claims about a product's green DNA, so to speak. So, you know, we've seen a rise in both. And I think this is all part of just working out. Companies are trying to, some seriously, some not so seriously, trying to work through this. And our book is for companies that are trying to do a better job in this area. And it's not easy, and it does not happen overnight. And you've got to pick your places, and you've got to be imaginative about it. But the benefits can be great, just in simply starting to differentiate yourself from your competitors.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is Bill Breen. He is the editorial director of Seventh Generation. It is the nation's fastest-growing brand of natural home and personal care products. He's also the co-author, along with Jeffrey Hollander, who is himself the co-founder and executive chairman of Seventh Generation. The two of them have written this book. The title of the book is The Responsibility Revolution, How the Next Generation of Businesses Will Win. And it's published by Jossie Bass. And it's out in the bookstores now. If you're interested, take a look at it. Questions, comments are welcome here, too. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think this community, the university community in the area, is seized with this idea of social entrepreneurship to a great extent. The local university, Y, has a whole series on it this semester. Muhammad Yunus was here, and I think by nature, the Grameen Bank is sort of a social entrepreneurship, giving money. A local developer has even started a fund to actually do small-scale financing for local entrepreneurs. And I think it's all well and good, but I still go back to the macro level. And, there are people making important criticisms, but I just don't think they get the same mileage as social entrepreneurship. So I'll just throw this out here as an example. The World Bank this week is seized with the question of a $3.9 billion loan to South Africa for the one of the biggest, I think, six biggest coal-burning plants in the world. It'll emit more carbon dioxide than 10 countries, including Belgium, or combined, I guess, Belgium thrown in. So it is a huge thing. It's a legacy of a deal that was signed during the apartheid regime, and it's going to, this week. Apparently, the Obama administration will abstain from all coal funding, which is a great idea, but I think they should vote against it myself, because this may be a bit of a digression, and I don't know how you'll respond to it, but it certainly has to do what's going to happen in the next couple of generations, the carbon dioxide debt. And so it just seems to me that this is well and good, but when you have these massive things going on at this other entire level of economics, it just seems that I want to at least ask you to respond to that, and you say perhaps these things too, I guess. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, but you see, so you've called in and with this point, and it speaks to some of one of the pressures that are brought on to companies and to enterprises, that there is more transparency than ever before, and people can follow this, and pressure can be brought to bear. That doesn't mean that it will always succeed, that these campaigns won't always succeed. But I don't know how it's going to play out in South Africa, of course. But that does show you some of the nature of the conversation that we're having these days, where we can be concerned about this, we can know about it, we can follow it. Over the past 15 years, non-governmental organizations have grown dramatically to where they've become the eighth largest economy in the world, with something like operating budgets of more than $1 trillion. So they don't always win, but they are exerting tremendous force on companies, and companies are definitely taking notice, even the reluctant ones. So they do tend to respond first in terms of their marketing and publicity, but then they get burned from that too if they don't follow through. And so then they take a deeper look, and this is sort of a step-by-step process. The companies that we profile in the book, by and large, are succeeding. We can't say how they're going to succeed next year. But if you look at the recession that we just came through, some of the companies that did the best during that time are companies that center themselves around a sustainable or responsible ethos.
And I guess I wonder whether people are going to think about, say in their choices for whatever products we're talking about, home care products or ice cream or sneakers or computers or whatever, given that, as the caller points out, there are these large forces at play in the global economy, do my choices on my level as an individual consumer really matter?
Well, they matter to a lot of people, like the first caller who's suffered from chemical allergies. And so they certainly matter on a great deal to a core group and one that's growing and that's taking their choices into consideration now, especially with developments in technology, where you're going to be able to walk down an aisle on your cell phone and download information on the products and the ingredients and whether the company is being transparent or not. This is going to make, again, for very much an educated, activated consumer. Now, consumers are going to sometimes shop by price, and where they have other issues on products that have more of an impact on their daily lives, they're going to put those values to the forefront. To companies, does that matter? Yes, of course that matters in a very big way, but we see in examples with Nike and IBM and some of the others I cited earlier, the consumer doesn't always enter into it. It's ways that they can decrease their manufacturing costs, give a radically different design to a product, seize on emerging opportunities where there's a problem. Usually there's an opportunity to have it solved, and a company like an IBM can step in. For a Marks and Spencer, it's a way for them to differentiate themselves from the big Walmarts and Tescos of the world. So companies have different reasons for wielding this, and I think it's what we're trying to show in the book and what many companies have already grasped, that this can really be a real competitive weapon in attacking their competitors and showing a way that they can differentiate themselves and attract high-end talent as well.
All right, let's go to another caller here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon, or good morning, I should say. This whole technology, I'm in the service industry, and I got to tell you, you can look a lot of stuff up on the Internet, which saves a lot of time, but you still end up going out to wherever the product might be. And, I don't see anytime soon where people, because it's hard to explain or to show people things on the Internet or that nature to without them going out and actually looking at whatever they want to buy. I think it's a great idea. I know of other companies that are doing things right now, but, they're not getting a lot of customer-based stuff. And, what I want to say is Craigslist and places like that, that's great, but I've known people to drive hundreds and thousands of miles to go pick up a vehicle or to pick up something to find out it's not what they thought it was.
Right.
So the sight unseen stuff, the computer stuff is fine if it's local, but still, again, it goes, when you get there, sometimes I find people making two trips instead of just one.
Right. Yeah. And this is all, you know, in flux. But I would argue then the evidence suggests that there's more and more transparency around the ingredients that are going into products. But it is an evolving process. I know, in our company, Seventh Generation, we've pushed for ingredient disclosure in household cleaning products for quite some time. And finally, we're seeing some move in that end, and we've been voluntarily doing it. And you can get it information on the web, through manufacturers' data sheets that you can download. And as I used in that earlier example of a shopper going down the shopping aisles, you'll be able to learn more through your cell phone. But is this a complete? By no means. But we're certainly moving in that direction. Information is more increasingly at our fingertips. Companies recognize that. They know they have to get it there. And I'd say this is an unstoppable force, but it's an evolving force.
Well, the caller made the point that certainly I was thinking about. That is, you used earlier used the term greenwashing,
right,
which is essentially means that companies doing something superficial in the way of promotion, marketing, and so forth to make it look as if they are responsible and they're concerned with their environmental impact and so forth. And the issue is that it's a very thin coating and that it's not really deep. And the question then is, for consumers, how do they sort among the available choices and determine whether somebody is really, whether it is indeed something that's just on the surface, or whether that is something that's actually deep?
Sure. Well, Google is a powerful tool, and you use that to sort of Google whether a company is following up on its proclamations, and you can learn pretty quickly. There's lots and lots of many more eyes out there that are watching, and transparency is one of the core requirements for any company that seeks to be call itself sustainable or responsible or green. And that, would be probably the first benchmark would be, is the company really organized around an authentic mission, and is it living that mission? That's the first question to ask, is all this authentic or just greenwashing? And the second one is, how transparent is this company? Is it a leader in its field in terms of disclosing the ingredients in its products? And are those ingredients disclosed in a way that it's comprehensible to people? What are the green groups saying, and activist groups saying about it? That's the transparency is probably the acid test for any company that really proclaims itself to be sustainable or responsible. And if it's not being transparent, then in its claims and producing evidence for those claims, then chances are it's not a really authentically responsible company.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that some companies, I think, have done some rather adventurous things in terms of transparency, going beyond labeling and going beyond, say, having a company website that gives information about the products. There are places that literally have thrown open their doors and have said to people who are concerned and organizations that are concerned, well, all right, come on down.
Right.
We'll show you around. We'll show you what we do here.
Yes, and one of the companies we wrote about in the book is a Danish pharmaceutical company, Novo Nordisk, which is the world's largest producer of insulin. And they were getting a lot of criticism for animal welfare activists because this company contracts with laboratories to do their animal testing. And the animals were housed in abhorrent conditions, and they were videotaped, and these videotapes got out, and Novo Nordisk, to their credit, instead of hunkering down and denying that there was a problem, admitted, yes, there is a problem. We're as horrified by this as you are, and we're going to invite you in and help and have you help us solve the problem. And that was a huge debate inside this company, because many scientists believed inside Novo Nordisk. They said, what are we doing? We're going to let these people in. They don't know about the science and the issues that we are confronted with. How can we trust them? And so there is this big trust issue. But you find when you bring transparency around what you're doing and you say, okay, we're going to invite you in, we're going to let you...
I think we just might have lost the guest there just then. Let's see if we can reestablish contact We are about 10 minutes away or so from the end of this hour of Focus, and this will give me an opportunity again to introduce the guest, which is something that I generally do at about this time. We're talking in this hour of Focus with Bill Breen. He is the editorial director of a company called Seventh Generation. This is the nation's fastest-growing brand of natural home and personal care products, and he is the co-author, along with Jeffrey Hollander, who's one of the founders and current executive chairman of Seventh Generation. What they have done is they have put together a book that takes a look at companies that have adopted this corporate responsibility as a business strategy and that demonstrate the fact that that can be something that can be actually very rewarding in business sense. And you can read about it if you take a look at their book, The Responsibility Revolution. The subtitle is How the Next Generation of Businesses Will Win. Jossie Bass is the publisher. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Breen, you there?
Hey, David, I'm back.
You just disappeared there.
I don't know. Maybe one of the critics pulled the plug.
That's possible. Anyway, we'll continue here for about another 10 minutes, and people have questions, comments, they can call in. Obviously, what you're doing here with this book is not only are you exploring this issue, but your readership, you think the people that are going to be reading this book are, in part at least, going to be people in business who are trying to figure out how to do this. And one of the things that you've said is that you have to... These principles have to become part of what you do and have to become distributed throughout of what you do. And you can't just take one person in the company and say, okay, you're going to be our green czar. You're in charge. You're the executive vice president of sustainability. Go to it. But apparently a lot of places, that's actually what they have done.
Yeah, that's the problem. They think they've done the right thing by appointing someone to take on these initiatives, but then they're just boxed inside the company. We call it deputized to be the green czar, but then they're compartmentalized, and they really don't have influence on the rest of the organization. And this happens a lot, particularly inside large organizations. So the trick is to try to get people to, first of all, elevate these folks, and so they're not just sitting off in one part of the organization, and they really don't have any influence on the rest of the organization. So companies that are succeeding in this area are taking sort of the green czar, if you will, and putting them on the top floor, you know, right around the corner from the CEO's office. And these folks are in on all the major strategy decisions that companies are making, so that sustainability and responsibility informs where they're putting their R&D money, where they're putting their top talent, where they're going to put their initiatives for the coming year or two moving forward. And so partly you're sending a message to the rest of the organization that this person is important and they have great business chops. They will help us succeed. And then, but, you know, to put the person's part, you know, what they have to do is really put in place some measures and some initiatives that will show the company that they are succeeding competitively, not just in their marketing, but that they are making a competitive difference with other organizations in their field. But you're absolutely right. It does. The companies do trip up in a lot of ways. And what happens is companies get in trouble because, on the one hand, they might be doing good in one area, but then they're doing business as usual in another, and that's where they usually get attacked.
Yeah. When you talk about companies having goals, ultimately, I suppose the goal is to, well, whatever it is that you do, if not dominate your sector, be a major player. And in the process, be financially successful. So there, I suppose, ultimately, if you're a sneaker company, your goal is to make and sell a lot of sneakers. How do you think about these other kinds of goals that are related to what you do, but they're not what you do? And how do you perhaps set some other goals or incorporate some other goals into your business that aren't really, I'm not doing a very good job asking this question, aren't really directly related to the business?
Sure. Well, you know, there are the day-to-day tactical things that you need to do as a company to succeed. But, you know, from when you look up, you know, at the end of the day, and you think about what it is, how am I really spending my life? What am I really doing with my life? Am I working with an organization that really is making a difference? That's when that sort of overall overriding mission really tends, you know, to matter to people. And, you know, Google will say, you know, Google is you know, these engineers are working with bits and bytes and writing zeros and ones all day long to create better search capacity or whatever initiative they're working on within Google. But on the other hand, they're realizing that, you know, the big mission is to enhance the world's knowledge base and to make information available to everyone. And that is a long-term but inspiring goal, and that's one of the ways that Google has managed to attract them, and the generous pay packages has managed to attract high-end talent. So I don't think it's an issue of separating the products that you make or the services that you provide from the mission, but understanding that those products and services grow out of the mission. Mm.
This you talked a little earlier about the fact that for a company, one of the advantages of trying to move in this direction is that it may be one thing that attracts people to want to come to work for your company, and that people, if they really believe in what you're doing beyond making whatever, that this will help you to attract really good people, and they'll want to work hard for the company because for them it will involve more than just collecting the paycheck. Now, having
said
all that, though, does it in fact, if you're going to do this, does this mean that your company has to be organized differently?
Yeah. So, you know, the expectation is if it's still a top-down sort of pyramid-shaped company where the big dogs sit at the top and bark at everybody else and tell them what to do, no matter what your mission is, that really isn't going to work over the long run. So if you're going to be a mission-oriented company, by definition, you need to think about creating a workplace where that mission permeates and a different kind of workplace. One that's, as we argue in the book, it's a little bit more organized like a community rather than a hierarchy. And so one of the companies we write about is Linden Lab, which is the makers of Second Life, which is this virtual world that people can log on to and create their own avatars and that kind of thing. And although there's a lot of fun in it, companies are now using Second Life as meeting places, as places to collaborate. So there is a mission there sort of advancing the world's knowledge and experience through these avatars that Second Life lives through. But they also are trying to organize the company as a bit more like a community and drive out fear in the workplace. And they do this through a little application that sits on people's computers called the Love Machine. And when someone does something that's good, that helps you out on, say, making a deadline or something, you simply type out a little called love note and you send it to that person. And so they get a little appreciation during the day. And what happens is that, on average, one person every day sends at least one of these love notes, and they start to accumulate. And at the end of every quarter, they're completely transparent, and everybody in the organizations can see where the love notes are going. So in any organization, you know who your stars are, but it's hard to find out who the unsung heroes are. And you find those out by looking where all the love notes are going, because those are usually the people who are making a difference in your organization. So here's a company that is organized around a mission. Try to create something that's more community-based rather than having people at the top recognize and reward performance, having people in the organization, throughout the organization, recognize and reward performance. And they do this just through this one little innovation that sits on your desktop computer.
I like that a lot, and I think initially my reaction to that, and I suppose some people's reaction would be to sneer and say, yeah, love notes, yeah, right. But when you tell that story and you explain how that works and what the sort of the end goal is, you say, oh, now that, actually, I can see that. I can see that that is a very good thing, because I'm sure that in so many places there is this gulf between the people on the top and who direct things and the people who do the work, and that people who do the work often feel underappreciated, and that doing this not only builds some sort of mutual appreciation, but that it ends up being something concrete that can be an indicator of people's productivity or, you know, what it is they contribute to the organization. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it is a little hokey, you know. I mean, but, you know, love is not a word that's mentioned in a lot of workplaces. And yet it's coming to the fore now. I mean, but it's just a way of sort of an antidote to usually the messages you get from people at the top, which is, you know, being a journalist is you missed your deadline. That's one I've heard before. Or, you know, you're in this economy, you're fired or whatever, or, you know, you're screwing up. That's the only time you're really here. So on that level of instead of getting hammered, you get, like, I don't know, a metaphorical equivalent of a rose or something. You know, you get a little reward, a little star. But on the other hand, it does serve the purpose of really knowing what are people doing. And the community is recognizing a performance within the organization. But it's a community recognition, not just from one or two people at the top.
We just have maybe a minute and a half, and we have mentioned some companies here or there. I don't know if there's any other company that just stands out in your mind as a really good example of what we've been talking about.
Well, you know, so Etsy, which is a sort of eBay for people in the craft business, is a really good example of a company reaching out and co-creating with their consumers and being extraordinarily transparent to people in terms of what, you know, their company's practices are and how they're interacting. And they get criticism directly, and Etsy will react on it. And that's another sort of theme for companies that want to make a difference, is you have to get very close to your consumers and really know them and cooperate. It's a cooperative sort of initiative. So the mission matters, transparency matters a lot, values and cooperation with your consumers and operating and working very closely with them is another sort of huge benchmark for companies that want to be authentically responsible.
There, we'll have to stop. For folks who are listening who want to read more on this subject, you should look for the book I mentioned, The Responsibility Revolution, How the Next Generation of Businesses Will Win, co-authored by our guest Bill Breen. He's the editorial director of Seventh Generation, the nation's fastest growing brand of natural home and personal care products. And Mr. Breen, thanks very much.
David, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.